Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, Republican lawmakers say the governor's budget proposal has the math wrong. And in an age of efficiency, one teacher wants us to appreciate the inefficiencies in sports. But first, the new Trump administration is moving fast to fulfill a long list of campaign promises on immigration in his first days in office. The president has signed dozens of executive orders already, including declaring a national emergency on the southern border, shutting down the CBP One app, which allowed immigrants to make appointments with officials in their quest to seek asylum. And he is attempting to end birthright citizenship as guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. Now, his new director of Homeland Security, Tom Homan, has announced an important change in immigration enforcement. He rescinded guidance that restricted immigration authorities from entering schools, healthcare facilities, and places of worship to conduct arrests. It is exactly what our next guest feared could happen. Last month, Reverend Jennifer Reddall, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Arizona, wrote an op-ed in the Arizona Republic, along with nearly a dozen other faith leaders across the state, arguing that immigration raids in their churches are a violation of religious freedom. It comes just months after Arizonans voted overwhelmingly to pass Proposition 314, making illegal border crossings a state crime and bringing up echoes of the controversial SB 1070 from 15 years ago. I spoke with Bishop Reddall more about it all before the administration's latest move to open up churches to immigration raids.
So I think some of our fears were realized with the executive order that got rid of the Border Patrol app that allowed asylum seekers to apply legally and in an orderly fashion. That's what the people who live in our shelter on the Mexican side of the border use, because we want them to do things the right way. We don't want them to use cartels to take them across the border illegally. We want them to use the right way, and the right way and the legal way just went away.
Okay, so we don't know what will, if anything, replace that at this point. But I want to ask about concerns going forward as well, because you were one of many faith leaders in the Valley who wrote an op-ed in the Republic recently talking about concerns about these kinds of things, about respecting the human rights of people as immigration laws shift, which they already are. What are you worried about in your congregations?
In our congregations, we're worried about how these are going to be enforced. We don't know about Prop 314 and how that's going to be enforced. You know, there are norms that say that you don't invade churches to arrest people, but those are just norms. So a lot of the norms seem to go away, so we aren't sure if we're going to be targeted. When SB 1070 was enforced, my understanding, I wasn't here yet, but my understanding is that Sheriff Arpaio parked himself outside of some of our churches and was trying to arrest people on their way out of church. We think that it's really important that every human being have the right to worship. You know, that's not one of the places that you should be arresting people. Everyone needs their freedom of religion. Everyone needs the chance to be with their community and worship their God. And we're worried that that's not going to happen.
So these sorts of concerns are about religious freedom for you, religious exercise.
It's about exercise of religious freedom. And it's also about the sanctity of churches that, that you know, we don't exist to uphold the state. We exist to be in a creative dialogue with the state, but also to hold the state to a moral compass. You know, we, as followers of Jesus, you know, I have really strong feelings about the dignity of human beings and about how everyone is made in the image of God. And, you know, the state doesn't have that same concern, but we get to be in dialogue about it.
Yeah, and I want to ask you more about that in a moment. But let me ask you first, what's happened already in your congregation since the passage of Prop 314 here in the Valley, which, as you said, is not being enforced yet. We don't know when and if it may be. But have you seen this happen? You have many churches that are bilingual Spanish-speaking.
So anecdotally, attendance is down in our Spanish-speaking churches. People are already afraid to come to church because of all of the rhetoric, even if it's not being enforced yet. People are afraid. And, you know, if you have to choose between going to church and being deported and leaving your kids behind, you're probably going to worship online.
Is family separation there part of the biggest concern for folks?
Family separation is absolutely one of the biggest concerns because we have a lot of families in our churches that are of mixed documentation status. And so the idea that a parent may have to leaving behind U.S. citizen children or a spouse, you know, that's kind of the worst scenario for us.
Let me ask you about how you're preparing for all of this. You and other religious leaders, I know, are talking about this, trying to figure out how to approach it. Are you talking to attorneys? Are you working with the people who might be able to assist people?
Yeah. So we just had a Zoom with an immigration attorney with all of my clergy a week and a half ago because, you know, we're in this position of learning. You know, I don't know how to do this. I'm not an immigration attorney, but I do need to know, and my clergy need to know, you know, what are our rights as citizens and as religious leaders? What are the rights of undocumented people if someone comes to the door and knocks? Mm-hmm. So we've gotten some good advice for that. I think we'll be doing some work in the churches again, you know, sort of putting together basically folders for people so that they have all of their important documents and their stuff together so that if someone, you know, gets picked up, their family can find them. They've got someone with power of attorney to help help find them and help take care of their kids. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of very anxious planning.
Yeah. How far would you be willing to take this, I wonder? Because I know we've seen in the past in Arizona, mm-hmm. you mentioned, you know, Sheriff Arpaio at the time waiting outside of churches to arrest people or talk to them. We've seen other churches act as sanctuaries, mm-hmm. protect and house undocumented immigrants and try to keep them from immigration officials. What does this look like for you?
That's probably not something that we would do in Arizona. We have done it in the past, and it's not, I don't think it's a bad thing to do. You know, there is some legal peril in there that probably outweighs the benefit. You know, I was familiar with some churches in New York City when I lived there who had people in sanctuary, and it's a great way of getting a lot of attention, but it's not necessarily a way of actually helping the vast numbers of people. And so for us, I think we're looking at helping the vast number of people. I want to help our fellow Arizonans. I want to help our law enforcement recognize that human beings are human beings. They're all made in the image of God. And that doesn't mean that no one should ever be deported. But it does mean that we have to think about this and doing it in a way that is not malicious and is not aimed at harming families.
Harming families. You're also affiliated, I understand, with the Lost Boys, this sort of mm-hmm. famous refugee community from Sudan that's been in the valley for some time. The new president on his first day in office suspended refugee resettlement for at least four mm-hmm. months going forward. What are your concerns there?
So I was with our Sudanese congregation on Sunday, and they are very anxious because from their perspective, they know how important it was for them to be able to come to the United States as refugees. Mm. That saved their lives. And now that they've been here for 20 plus years, they are married, they have kids, their kids are Americans, they're American citizens, and they're kind of a huge success story. And they're afraid that the doors are closing for those who are coming behind them.
You mentioned a border shelter. What does that look like? What's the reaction been there on the border itself?
Yeah, so we run a shelter on the Mexican side of the border for families and women who are wanting to apply for asylum. They come from all over the world, you know, from China, from Russia, from El Salvador, from Mexico, Guatemala. And, you know, we only take families, so it's a lot of kids. And they have been through just horrific experiences whenever I hear their stories. And we make sure that what we do, you know, people have some time to stay there to get on the app, make the legal way to apply for asylum, which was through the app, make an appointment so that you can present yourself. And we don't want to support cartels. We don't want to support people just jumping over the wall or going around it. And so that app was taken offline yesterday. And so now there's no legal way for people to apply for asylum. And I don't know what's going to happen. We've probably got about 120 people in that shelter. I know in December I was down there and we were talking about a family that was crossing and thinking, wow, this may be the last family that crosses. And that's just heartbreaking because, you know, they can't go back. They don't have anywhere to go.
Let me ask you lastly about the role you see faith leaders like yourself playing in this conversation. I'm sure there are people out there who will hear this and say, you know, they're not policy experts. They're not people who are working in government. What's your role you see this?
So I think as a follower of Jesus and somebody who reads the Bible quite a lot, I'm somebody who recognizes that the entire scripture is a story of people on the move. It's a story of people migrating. You know, the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, is stories of the people of Israel moving. The New Testament is the story of Jesus in his family, you know, going to Egypt and then coming back to Nazareth. So we have, you know, in our religious traditions, a very high understanding that you have to protect the alien among you, and that all of us have experienced being what they call strangers, right? Mm. You were a stranger in Egypt. And so with that experience, then we look out at the world and say, okay, well, how today in 2025 am I called to welcome the stranger, just like I was, you know, commanded to do in the Bible?
Hmm. All right, we will leave it there. That is Bishop Jennifer Reddall, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese here in Arizona. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So those are the concerns of one religious leader in Arizona who could now be facing immigration raids in her congregations under the Trump administration's new guidelines. Now let's turn to someone who can shed some light on how the Arizona public might respond should these policies be carried out. Samara Klar is a political science professor at the University of Arizona, and she's conducted polling on immigration in our state for years. She told me while Arizonans might have voted Trump into office on the promise of mass deportations, they're not necessarily anti-immigrant. In fact, she says, according to her polling, Arizona is a relatively pro-immigrant state. I spoke with her more about what she found and why most Arizonans seem to separate immigrants from border security.
So in the polling that I've done throughout Arizona, and this has really been going on for, you know, several years now, maybe almost 5 years, I do polls at least once a year on a random sample of Arizonans. And I find pretty open attitudes towards immigration. What I mean when I say that are, you know, an appreciation for immigration, support for example, paths to citizenship, particularly for immigrants who arrived here as young children, general skepticism or opposition to deportation. Now, of course, that's not to say people aren't concerned about the border. Absolutely, they are. Mm. But Arizonans, I think, really rely on immigration economically within their communities. I think a lot of Arizonans know immigrants if they're not themselves immigrants. So yeah, the population here, at least in the polling that I've done, seems to be fairly supportive of having a diverse population with lots of immigrants.
Interesting. So yes, people will say good things in general about immigration. You said they will report that it makes immigrants make the state better. But there are concerns that people have, right? Like, what's the differentiation there? What are the concerns?
Well, this year in particular, and this, you know, increased throughout the year, when I would ask, you know, how concerned are you about security at the U.S.-Mexico border, there was very high levels of concern among both Republicans and Democrats. So, you know, the support for immigration doesn't mean that people are fine with what's going on at the border. In fact, they're very concerned with the border. And I would break that down a little bit, and I would say, you know, what about the border concerns you?
Right, yeah.
Is it the fact that people are coming through? Is it the fact that drugs and weapons are coming through? And of course, as you might expect, the greatest concern that we see among Arizonans has to do with fentanyl, drugs, weapons. When it comes to individuals themselves immigrating across the border, then there's significantly less concern.
That's really interesting. So if somebody says, you know, I'm concerned about the border, yes, it doesn't necessarily mean they're anti-immigrant or against the people themselves.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that really gets lost a lot kind of in the media narrative about it. If you ask this question, are you concerned about immigration? Are you concerned at the border? You're going to have, you know, maybe 80, 85% of Americans will say yes. And then you can sort of interpret that however you want to interpret it. So I think it's really important in these surveys to have detailed follow-up questions. What about the border is concerning to you? Hmm. For most people, the idea that we're going to have, you know, people immigrating from other countries, from South America, from Central America, that in and of itself is not concerning. But there is a very high level of concern about this idea that, you know, dangerous drugs are coming through, there's human trafficking, there's weapons coming in from the southern border, or even, you know, from the northern border, as we've seen, you know, Trump talking about. That's a kind of a different situation altogether.
Yeah, yeah. So let's then talk about the immigrants who are here, right? Like, we are watching a new Trump administration come into office right now and we're expecting, as he has promised, mass deportations of people who are presumably already in the country. Where do Arizonans stand on that?
Well, you know, if you ask a broad question, do you believe that undocumented immigrants should be deported back to their country of origin. Arizonans are not very supportive of that as a concept. I find upwards of 60% of Arizonans to a certain degree oppose that idea. Really only about a third will say, yes, I support deportation. Now, of course, once you dig in with a little more detail, okay, what about an unauthorized immigrant who's committed a heinous crime? Well, then yes, support is going to exponentially.
Yeah.
So it kind of depends on the context that you're laying out. When we're talking about immigrants who came as children, who came when they were younger, there's overwhelming support for allowing those Arizonans to stay in what is really truly their home.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to talk about Proposition 314 that just passed a few months ago here in Arizona, pretty overwhelmingly by voters here. It was compared to the very controversial SB 1070, the notorious kind of show me your papers law of 2010.
Yeah.
But there was massive outrage and protests in the street, a lot of negative reaction to SB 1070 when it was passed by the state legislature, you know, 15 years ago, but not to this. Why not?
You know, it was fascinating. When this ballot measure was first presented, I initially thought, as you said, that we were going to see sort of a repeat of the 1070 outrage. This was going to become a real focal point for the election. Not at all what happened. First of all, the Democrats barely talked about it. We didn't really hear a lot of opposition. There wasn't really a lot of movement, a lot of activism around it. And almost immediately, especially in polling, I started to see really high support for it. So in the polls that I was doing in the summer and the fall before the election, over two-thirds of my respondents said that they supported this law. And that's about the same percentage that ultimately did vote for it in November. So I think there was a couple things going on. One of the biggest differences, I think, is part of me really felt as though the Republicans were maybe getting it on the ballot almost as bait for Democratic candidates to come out and oppose it and then appear weaker on the border. Mm. Because the border was such a contentious issue and there were so many Arizonans who were really genuinely very concerned about the border. And the Democrats didn't do that. If anything, what we saw in 2024 were Democratic candidates like Gallego and Harris taking very strong stances on border security. Another reason I think we saw so much support for this ballot measure, which, by the way, may never even go into effect, the wording brought in all these different concerns that we just talked about. So, you know, I was just saying some people are concerned about people coming across the border. Others are concerned about guns and fentanyl and trafficking. 314 was just like a word soup of all of these things. They talked about fentanyl. They talked about weapons. So no matter what you're concerned about, whether you're concerned about the guns or the people or the fentanyl, it appeals to you. And there was a lot for people to hold on to. Liberal supporters, Harris supporters, Democratic supporters really showed very high support for it. And the polling that I was doing, you know, I was finding that both Trump and Harris supporters said that they were going to vote for it. In my polls, 40% of people who said that they planned to vote for Harris also planned to support this ballot measure.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. So last question for you then, looking forward, like there's a lot of uncertainty right now as to how these mass deportations might be carried out. But what are you watching for going forward as all of this plays out? Like, do you anticipate a backlash if we start to see families separated, if we start to see people, you know, swept up in workplace raids, things like that?
Yeah, you know, it's always hard to know with any administration, and I think maybe especially with the Trump administration, how much of the rhetoric is real promises that will come true and how much of it is maybe negotiation tactics with other countries or an attempt to kind of push the agenda a little further to one direction or another. I know in Arizona, and I think probably a lot of people who live in Arizona feel this way, there's a lot of nervousness and anxiety about it. We don't know if this is actually going to be ever enforced. I think there may have been an assumption among Democratic candidates that opposing this bill would make them seem weak and the bill will never actually go into effect anyway. So, you know, maybe that was part of the strategy. So I think, you know, we just don't know. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what happens.
Yeah. All right. Lots to watch for. Samara Klar, a political science professor at U of A, joining us to talk about her polling on immigration in Arizona. Samara, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Great chatting with you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what drives humanity to focus on the positive?
Things like contentment or hope or forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm working on kindness. So all of these topics fit within positive moral philosophy. And I've always felt as a philosopher that I've just been working on the fringe, right? Because a lot of people aren't working on this.
A look into the new field of positive moral philosophy. But first, Governor Katie Hobbs is facing down an emboldened Republican majority in the state legislature and re-election in just 2 years, which is like 2 minutes in politics today. So we are seeing her make moves to the middle, and that's reflected in her budget proposal for the next fiscal year. Instead of trying to get rid of the GOP's prized school voucher program like she has in years past, she's hoping to put income limits on it. She's hoping to work with Republicans on housing and homelessness and is asking for $20 million to boost border security and a pay raise for frontline law enforcement and correctional officers. But yesterday at the state capitol, Republican lawmakers met many of those proposals with skepticism, and they say her math doesn't add up. Here to explain is our own Wayne Shutsky with KJZZ's Politics Desk. Hi there, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so first of all, remind us of some of the highlights of the governor's spending plan here. This is supposed to be sort of a jumping off point, right, for negotiations with the GOP majority for what priorities might happen this session.
Yeah, so listeners might remember there's a big child care package in there trying to cut the cost of child care for working class, lower income and some middle income folks. There's some proposals in there to increase the supply of affordable housing and then raises for DPS workers, correction workers, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. And a little bit of money for local law enforcement down near the border to do things like stopping the flow of fentanyl into the state.
So some of these proposals from the governor were obviously going to be complete non-starters with the Republican majority. Like what?
Like you mentioned the voucher income cap, which would basically take the state's school voucher program and make folks who earn over $200,000 a year ineligible. And it would also reduce the price of the voucher for folks that earn between $100,000 and $200,000 per year on kind of a sliding scale, depending on how much they earn. And Republicans basically said, as was not a surprise, that is a no-go. David Livingston on the Appropriations Committee in the House said, I am telling you no right now. So not unclear about that.
Not unclear. Okay. Are there any potential points of agreement? Are there places in this budget proposal where they can start talking about making some changes?
There were some small ones. Livingston specifically told me that 5% raise for DPS and corrections workers, he likes that. He likes some smaller investments in, like, I think there was like a meat inspector or something like that that could help with safety. You could see some agreement maybe on the housing stuff, the affordable housing supply. That's been something Republicans and Democrats have been working towards, though Republicans expect some skepticism about how Hobbs wants to do it. So there might be some room to work there, but those are kind of the only ones they were pointing out at this point.
Okay. And they also said that there are some problems with the math here, right? Like the Republicans say that the governor's spending plan like literally doesn't add up. What's their claim?
Yeah, this was the bigger issue. And they're like, kind of before we can get to the finer points of the policies you mm-hmm. want to enact here, we have to resolve this issue. It, you know, they're saying that basically the revenues that Hobbs thinks are going to come into the state and then her projected expenses in a variety of categories kind of aren't adding up to what the legislature saw there. And so they're like, you know, we can't even look at how we're going to spend this money if we don't agree on how much money we have to spend, essentially.
Mm. Does this look legit based on kind of your own calculations, Wayne?
I wouldn't say my calculations. I'm not going to try and say I'm better at math than the budget folks on either side, the legislature or the governor's office. But the complaint seems legitimate. It originated with Representative Matt Gress, who used to actually create the budgets for Governor Doug Ducey. And one of the big issues is access, the state's Medicaid program. The governor's budgets project not just the next fiscal year, but actually a total of 3 years out. And they're saying in 27 and 28, they're not accounting for any growth in the program, which Gress said is unheard of. There's growth every year. And so they're saying that, you know, they accounted for it next year. They think it was a 4% growth, but then the years following, it's just zero. And that and some other expenses in access that aren't accounted for, Republicans are projecting $840 million in expenses. So they're saying that kind of, you know, that's a significant chunk of mm-hmm. this new spending the governor wants in other areas. And if you're not accounting for that access growth, well, then, you know, you're basically creating money out of thin air, is their argument.
Hmm. What's the governor's office had to say about that?
They didn't give any answers to lawmakers yesterday during a budget presentation that Republicans were happy with. They basically just said this is going to be part of future conversations. pointed out that, you know, the governor's budget office and legislative budget analysts kind of create their own projections every year, which is true. And it's not unusual for them to come up with different revenue numbers, different spending numbers that vary a little bit. And, you know, but at this point in time, because it's all based on projections and different data points that they're pulling in, but just completely leaving out a kind of large expense that they know is going to happen. They might not know the specifics. Mm-hmm. That's the issue Republicans took. They're like, we're not necessarily upset that what we think that growth is going to be is different. It's that you didn't include it at all.
Mm. Okay, so last couple of minutes here. Let's talk about 2026, which is coming up fast in politics here. The governor is going to be running again for re-election and in a very different political environment to the one where she was voted in 2022. And we had some big news on this front this week from Arizona Congressman Andy Biggs, who filed an official statement of interest to run for governor in 2 years. Is this a surprising move?
No, there's been a lot of speculation in recent months that Biggs was going to throw his hat in the ring to run for governor. He is a ally of former president or current president Donald Trump. Sorry, I keep getting my formers and my currents all mixed up in the past few days. And, you know, he's well liked by kind of the further right wing of the party, the MAGA wing of the party. So he's been in Congress for several years. And, you know, apparently he's deciding that now might be the time to take that next step.
President Trump already endorsed a Republican in this race, though, that hasn't even officially declared that she's running. This is Republican businesswoman Karen Taylor Robeson.
Yeah, and that could be the biggest hurdle for Biggs to clear, is that kind of in Republican politics, the Trump endorsement is gold, and it has continued to be that way in most races, I should say, you know. But if Biggs can't get that endorsement, get Trump to flip or maybe double endorse like he mm-hmm. did with Blake Masters and Abe Hamadeh in a congressional race recently, that could, you know, his run for governor could end before it begins.
Mm. So say Biggs was able to win a GOP primary in Arizona coming from kind of the far right wing of the party. What kind of chance might he have in a statewide race?
Again, I always tell people I'm not a great prognosticator. Maybe I'm too close to these things. But I would say that I see a difficult uphill climb. I mean, if you look at Biggs' politics, they're very similar to the politics of Carrie Lake, who lost to Hobbs. So I think that's some of the driving force behind why Trump endorsed Taylor Robeson, who lost to Lake in the previous primary, and a lot of folks thought maybe she would have had a better shot at defeating Hobbs in the past general election. So it's difficult to see. He does have a lot more experience in government, but yeah. I don't know if that's a winning message for folks in the MAGA wing of the party who often talk about the swamp and the entrenched folks. So I see it being a difficult challenge for him, given the fact of how similar he is aligned with Lake and her inability to win statewide office in Arizona.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky joining us from our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. People are looking for efficiencies in all sorts of areas of society, from business to education to life in general. But my next guest says the drive for efficiency and the use of technology and data to do it should maybe have some limits. Billy Robb is a Valley High School teacher and writes the Cholla Express column on Substack. He recently wrote about how analytics and technology are impacting sports, and not always, in his opinion, for the better. In his piece, Robb writes, quote, "To value the human element is to appreciate that, unlike machines, we can find enjoyment and meaning in our inefficiencies." And when he and my co-host Mark Brody spoke recently, he asked Robb what he means by that.
Yeah, I think distinguishing between the perspective or the point of view of what I call technological efficiency versus the human element. And, you know, the human experience is vast, and it's not all aspects of the human experience can be measured and put into numbers. Just for example, reading a novel where you're sitting down, you're reading a story that someone else has written, and you experience it, right? You're pondering the story. You can look up from the book and make an insight or think about something about your life while you're doing that. And that's an inefficient task, reading a book or reading a novel. So I think if we could say, well, what if we could just plug in a Neuralink connection to your brain and have the computer download that book into your brain? It would just be different, right? You would still have the elements, the story in your memory, but you wouldn't have the experience of it. And that kind of that effective emotional insight aspect of human life is valuable and it's meaningful.
So where do you draw the line? Because your piece was mostly about these inefficiencies and trying, you know, some people trying to adjust them in the world of sports. And you start with, for example, instant replay in baseball and basketball. Where do you draw the line between, for example, trying to get a call right, in some cases a very important call right, as opposed to interrupting the flow of the game?
Yeah, I don't know if I would think of it as drawing a line where this is the exact policy that should be done in a certain instance. The point of my piece is just to sort of reflect on what's lost when we do implement technological tools like video replay. And the goal is to correct those calls, as you say. I think most fans would say, well, we have this technology, we should use it, but there's no way to perfect the calls. And even many times watching an instant replay review, fans are still arguing about it afterwards. So it doesn't eliminate the subjective element of the refereeing. And I don't think fans today would say we're much more satisfied with the way referees are calling the game now that we have instant replay. I think they're just as dissatisfied. It just takes longer time.
Well, so I'm curious what you make then of the idea of the automated strike zone in baseball, which a lot of fans have been clamoring for. And at the same time, a lot of fans are like, I'm not sure, because for the very same reason, sort of takes the human element out of it. But the proponents will say, look, this is an instantaneous thing. So I'm curious what you make of something like that, where it's, in theory, making sure the calls are right, but not taking more time.
I do think that would be a little different because it's instantaneous and because it would be the same for every single person. So that's one element in baseball that could be an easy fix. But, you know, in basketball, it would be extremely difficult to have a robot call fouls or something because it's such a quick and subjective thing.
Well, and you write about basketball, and sort of the overarching theme, it seemed to me, was analytics in terms of players and teams focusing more on three-point shots now, as opposed to, you know, working the offense through and sort of finding the best available shot, whether it's a three or a two. We've seen this in other sports as well. I think maybe most notably baseball, where you had shifts were very popular to the point where the league had to ban them to some extent. I'm curious what you think about, you know, teams using, like it, you talked about, there's not so much a balance or a line to be drawn, but, you know, teams are obviously wanting to use data and analytics to find an advantage to win the game, which I think most fans would be in favor of. But at the same time, to your point, when it goes maybe too far, it takes something away from the game. When you have, you know, four infielders on one side of the infield, knowing that that's where the batter's going to hit it, it kind of makes it less fun.
Yeah, so that's, as you say, what's the purpose of sports? Well, it's a competitive thing. It's a cultural experience. And it's also entertainment. It's fun. So from the perspective of a coach, if you find this tool that can statistically improve your chances of getting more points on the board, you're going to take it. But from a fan experience, it doesn't necessarily make it more interesting and more fun.
Well, so I guess that kind of comes down to the question to some extent of which is more important, having an enjoyable experience for the fan or winning the game, or at least putting yourself in the best position as a team to win the game.
I think if you're a team, your job is to try to win the games. Now, I push back a little bit on that because I think in sports, there's so many factors that are involved. So for a basketball team, high volume 3-point shooting is one factor. There's a million other different factors and statistics that you can look at. So your job is to win the game. If the statisticians are telling you that high volume 3-point shooting is how you get an advantage, you're probably going to do it. But it's kind of like smartphones and social media. We're not going to go back, I don't think, because advanced statistics are out there and teams are going to use them for an advantage. So it's just how do fans react to it, and then how do leagues try to respond to that, you know, once the consumer has been weighing in.
Right. What kinds of parallels do you see between what you've written about here in sports and maybe the world outside of sports?
I think the technological efficiency mindset is growing, is expanding, and it's being involved in pretty much all aspects of human life. I mean, my profession is I'm a teacher, and I get frustrated with just test scores. You know, test scores is a measurement. It's a statistic, and we have different approaches. And if that's the statistic, that's what we're going for. That's what we're trying to get at the end of the day. But there's, to me, there's so much more about education that doesn't necessarily show up in a test score.
It's interesting, you know, over the course of history, sports has been kind of seen as, in some cases, a reflection of society, in some cases, like a window into society. I wonder if in this instance, you see sports sort of as one of those, or maybe a metaphor for society at large in terms of the drive for getting rid of inefficiencies and making sure the calls are right and, you know, using analytics to try to gain every possible advantage, perhaps at the expense of the overall sort of pure experience of the event.
Yes, I definitely agree 100%. And it's just another example of the trade-offs involved. You know, we have social media. It allows us to connect with more people. It allows us to keep in touch with people. But there's trade-offs involved in losing time and attention. And with almost every one of these digital technologies, there's trade-offs. And I think maybe we're getting you know, these digital tools have only been around for about 20 years or so. I think it's possible we're getting to the point where people are starting to reflect on it a little more and saying, well, maybe we've gone too far into this technological mindset, but there's still going to be more technology. We're just now on the brink of the artificial intelligence revolution here. So it's unpredictable.
All right. That is Billy Robb, a high school teacher and author of the Cholla Express Substack. Billy, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Cheshire Calhoun is a philosophy professor at ASU, and she's fascinated by kindness. Calhoun's area of expertise is called moral philosophy, and she says that over the years, the field has narrowed its focus too much. Many of her colleagues have grown fixated on what she calls non-elective moral behaviors, questions like what makes us obey street signs or refrain from shoplifting. Those behaviors may be moral, but they're not necessarily motivated by kindness. Calhoun is more interested in elective moral behaviors, things like volunteer work or asking with genuine concern after a friend's sick parent. These, she says, are examples of positive moral philosophy, a new branch of academic study she's looking to establish at the university level. She wants to focus on what motivates the small but significant positive social behaviors we often overlook. Calhoun recently spoke about it with the show's Sam Dingman.
I moved here about a year ago from New York City, and one of the laboratories of this kind of thing in my mind is the subway, where a trope on the subway is that somebody will be crying and somebody will just walk over to them and hand them a Kleenex.
Oh, that's lovely.
And then they don't ask them if everything's okay. They don't try to fix anything. It's just kind of like, I think you might need this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now. Would that be a good example?
That's a very good example. I think it's an example of a kindness and that kind of personal recognition of ourselves, our needs, and responsiveness to them, I think, is really important to living in a moral community.
Right. And there's no reward that comes from a gesture like that necessarily. No tangible reward.
No tangible reward. Right. You might end up feeling good about yourself.
And why is this interesting to you?
A couple of very different reasons, right? So I'm a moral philosopher, and, you know, I think it's partly my responsibility to look after my own field. And when I became aware of this rather narrowing of our mission, I thought, well, it's time to maybe do something about it. Now, on the personal end, you know, this is a very self-interested my part. The reason why I want to launch this new field is that for many years now, I've been working on various topics that actually I realized count as positive moral philosophy. So things like contentment or hope or forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm working on kindness. So all of these topics fit within positive moral philosophy. And I've always felt as a philosopher that I've just been working on the fringe, right? Because a lot of people aren't working on this. But I'm working on the fringe only because we don't have a named field.
Okay. So if I'm hearing you correctly, then one of the things that's intriguing about positive moral philosophy as a discipline is that it's actually already being studied in kind of discrete forms across other arenas of philosophy. And part of what you're doing is proposing the idea that we might collect these disparate forms of study under one point of view.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. So one of the things I did was I did this huge literature search just to find what had been published over the years that I thought fell into positive moral philosophy. And there was quite a bit, but it's all over the map. You know, so there's work on moral revolutions, there's work on hope, there's work on elective forms of moral action. So all of these different kinds of things that you wouldn't think of automatically as belonging in the same domain, unless you had this way of framing it and you could see, oh, this is a different way of orienting work in moral philosophy. And they actually fit together. Yeah.
And where do we generally get our point of view on morals from?
I mean, I would say more generally, we start getting our moral understandings just by being socialized into our culture, right? So we learn what the rules are and we learn what the moral gifts are. And many of these important social practices are ones that become automatic for us just through socialization, right? So you just learn, you automatically hold the door open for somebody else, you know, so you automatically tell the truth for the most part, or keep your promises, right? So we really do count on people all around us to have a really good sense of basically what the moral norms are, what good moral behavior is, and to automatically comply with it.
One of the words that you have used in describing a lot of our tendency towards these behaviors is that we're socialized into these ways of interacting with each other.
Yeah.
But we live in an increasingly desocialized world, increasingly disconnected. You know, the word social is in social media, but it is often a very antisocial way of interacting.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Are we, in fact, becoming more disconnected from each other, or are we becoming more intensely connected and interactive with each other, and so finding more opportunities that really make it difficult to us for us to interact well and think about, well, what's the best way to proceed? You know, should I be angry and shouting at this person, or are there some other strategies that I could use to stay connected? So, you know, it may be just that we haven't really developed sufficient strategies for the level of social interaction that we are now all involved in.
That's very interesting. You've brought up this idea of kindness a couple of times, and it strikes me as you're talking about it that I've never really thought about what kindness actually means.
Yeah. Our sense of what kindness is comes from the etymology of kindness, of being of the same kind. You know, it has to do with your family members, your close friends, and so on, your kinship relations. So a great contemporary example of someone who expresses that kind of kindness is Ted Lasso from the Ted Lasso show. So what he does is he treats everybody as like kin, as like family, and he does the things for them that you would do for people who are family or are friends. And he uses it in a really transformative way to ultimately transform the relationships he has.
I'm so glad you brought up the Ted Lasso example, because I think it gets at something else, which is that part of the reason Ted Lasso works as a show is that Ted Lasso's kindness and his uncynicism is jarring to people. The people he interacts with.
Yeah, they don't trust it. Yeah, that's so interesting to note, because, you know, you think that many people who are moral exemplars might actually be received in that same way, not just admired, but also viewed with a kind of cynical suspicion. It's like, oh, what are they getting out of it? Or, you know, is there something further in mind? And we forget about the importance of a positive response to good behavior. It's really important to receive these little tokens of moral recognition from other people. And I think it has to do with the irreplaceable individuality of persons, right? You don't want to just be recognize as one among many moral equals in this sea of humanity, right? You also want people to notice you and somehow recognize that even though you're just one individual, you matter morally.
Yeah. All right. Well, Cheshire Calhoun is a professor of philosophy at ASU, and her new discipline, in partnership with many others, is positive moral philosophy. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. It's great.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.